Welcome to Breakfast at Beverley's, the podcast that takes you on a journey through the fascinating world of transport and logistics. Join your host, Beverley Bell CBE, an industry expert and former senior traffic commissioner, as she navigates the highways and byways of the industry. From sunrise to sunset, we're here to accompany you on the road, bringing you insights, advice, and thought-provoking conversations with notable guests in the field. We hope you enjoy this episode.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Breakfast at Beverley's. And today I'm thrilled to be joined by the award-winning motoring journalist and transport campaigner, Quentin Wilson. Many of us will remember Quentin from Top Gear, Fifth Gear, and his powerful campaigning on fuel prices, electric vehicles, and road safety. I like to think I have a special connection with Quentin as well. Back in 2017 at the Microlise conference, when I was stepping down as the senior traffic commissioner, Quentin hosted the event. As I came off stage, he suggested I might like to consider consultancy once I retired. Well, I took him at his word, and here we are today. So join us for what I know will be a lively and fascinating conversation, which I'm very much looking forward to. Thank you.
Good morning, Quentin. First of all, thank you so much for joining us. I'm going to ask you the standard question I always do. What have you had for breakfast, and do you have a good, healthy morning routine?
Just one piece of toast with butter and jam, and that's a couple of cups of coffee.
Sounds delicious. Do you have a sort of early morning fitness routine, or are you like me where you avoid it like the plague?
I tend to avoid it. I mean, like today, I'm straight into a foreign call at 7:30. So, you know, you've got to be up at 6 and get your head together and sort yourself out and straight into it. So the idea of going down to gyms or going for walks, lovely, but not possible.
I like you more and more, Quentin. So we first met in 2017.
We did indeed, Beverly, yeah.
And that was the time at which I was retiring from being a traffic commissioner. And we had some really good discussions about issues facing the industry at that time. And you threw down a challenge to me to maybe set up a little bit of a consultancy, which is what I've done. And I'd be grateful to you. Don't ask for commission, Quentin. But looking back now in 2017 and looking now at the state of the fleet of commercial vehicles in Great Britain, clearly electrification of vehicles, autonomous vehicles, so many changes on the horizon. You've always been a great advocate for the commercial vehicle industry. And obviously you took part in you were key in the Fair Fuel campaign. What's the challenges now, Quentin, facing the commercial vehicle industry with regard to the electrification of commercial vehicles and operators' fleets?
There are multiple. I think we've got to start from a position, Beverly, and I've said this to you before, where government needs to appreciate the role of these hauliers, what they do, how important they are to the lifeblood of the country. Without them, you know, we would just grind to a terminal halt. And yet they don't get any kind of recognition, I think, is the word I'm looking for. You know, when you look at how they have to sleep in their cabs and how difficult it is to find parking places and amenities and things like that, we don't recognise what these knights of the road do. And I've always been very conscious. It's like taxi drivers. You know, they're not valued as members of society. So I think that would be a platform that I would start from. I would have to say, look, to encourage talent into the industry, a new generation, because it's not a great life. It's not a great job driving all those miles. And they do it, let's be fair, incredibly well and incredibly safely when you look at the billions of miles travelled. Mm. So we need to appreciate them as members of society and give them the facilities and the wages and the appreciation that they deserve. That would be my starting point. Then when you look at the electrification of commercial vehicles, it's a hugely, hugely challenging prospect, but one that we've kind of got to do. And the OEMs, the truck manufacturers like Mercedes and DAF and Volvo, they're doing really well. And they're producing, you know, trucks that can do these distances. And Musk with his, like him or loathe him, with his semi in America, we know that the technology now works. So for the industry, the challenges are huge. much more than passenger cars. But we know that the OEMs have been doing really well producing technology in lorries that works and can do the distance. But it's not something that the industry can solve itself. I mean, what's happened with passenger cars is that a charging network has broadly been built by, you know, private enterprise, private capital, venture capital. But I think to expect the commercial and haulage industry to do that is wrong. So government's got to step in and say, right, we need proper charging infrastructure for lorries. So that means, you know, 350 kilowatt chargers that can charge them quickly, big areas where they can park and turn. And we need them regularly all down the strategic motorway network, as well as depot charging as well. And to build that infrastructure and say, right, this is the platform upon which we're going to build the electrification of Britain's commercial vehicle infrastructure. And all it needs is the political will. But, you know, I will probably repeat this multiple times in this podcast, getting government, not buy-in, but just to get them to understand the enormity of the challenge and what's involved. You know, I have such a job even getting them to understand about electric cars, never mind electric trucks. So, you know, I flag this up and say, we need to do this as a society, because, you know, you look at China, you look at other countries, they really are driving this electrification forward, and we will fall behind unless we pick up the pace.
Okay. Can I come back to you on three things there that you've talked about? You've talked about lorries. Some of our listeners, indeed many of our listeners, also run commercial passenger carrying vehicles, whether it's buses, coaches, and I think there's very similar challenges there. Clearly for coaches, entirely different than it is for buses that are doing much, much shorter journeys. And you mentioned that it's wrong for the industry itself to pay, but it's also probably impossible, because when you look at some of the margins that operators make, you've talked about the challenges that they face, they simply can't afford it. Would you agree with that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you look back, Beverly, to when we did first meet in 2017, the industry was under great stress and margins were really thin. I think they're probably worse in 2025. You know, people are really, really struggling. And I go back to that central point that we don't appreciate them, value them and pay them enough. So whatever the reasons for that, you know, we need to look at it and make sure that it is viable for commercial operators to make this incredible investment and to make sure that the government supports it whenever we can. Because without them, and this is it, without that commercial vehicle industry, we stop as a country.
Yes, absolutely. And so does the economy completely. So are you positive about the new government? Are you optimistic that the new government's going to be more receptive to the issues that you're raising? Because you're only asking them at this stage to understand, let alone buy in.
Thus far, Beverly, my experiences haven't been great, because here's the thing, before they were elected, Labour were really positive about the whole electrification and EV and GB energy and all this sort of stuff. And we had such high hopes, and we've done our best to engage. So for background, I run a campaign group called Fair Charge. So we educate press, public and politicians on electrification and try and support it as much as we can, because I just believe it's the right thing to do for air quality and our children and not being dependent on fossil fuels. So we work with people like the Department for Transport, but getting engagement at a ministerial level has thus far been really hard. And I think, you know, they've had enough time and we need to get sorted out, and let's have some meetings and say, look, this is what you need to do. The problem is they don't drive electric cars themselves. This is a major, major problem. So to them, it's an abstract concept. And I think, you know, I say this again and again, and people sort of roll their eyes at me. You know, I want the whole cabinet to be driving electric cars. If ministers are telling us to drive them, they should be showing an example and driving them themselves. And it's just not good enough that they're not. So I'm reserving judgment, but I'd like to see more interaction and more engagement.
Okay, so what can the industry do to support and help you in that? And what can the trade associations do to help and support you in that? And I know you've got experience of working with the trade associations.
Yeah, I mean, the haulage trade associations, RHA, people like that, they do a really, really, really good job. And they are in Westminster a lot and they are lobbying. And I think everything they can do to flag these issues up is great. And if we can help and work with them, then that would be good as well. But it, you know how it works. It's public pressure. You have to make these things important. You have to have questions asked in the House of Lords and the House of Commons. And that way you get ministers' attention. And that, I'm afraid, is what you have to do. And things like drop-ins for MPs, where we explain what it involves building infrastructure for heavy goods vehicles, you know, the investment required to buy a battery truck. And also, we can't do this in a tearing hurry. We can't set targets where HGVs have to be electrified or they'll be fined. You know, we need to do this in a grown up, measured, practical, pragmatic way. Otherwise, you know, it's going to get pushed back and it's going to get derailed. So, you know, there's a lot we can do, but it needs the political will, Beverly.
How do you maintain your optimism, Quentin?
Well, because you have to, Beverly, don't you? In life, you just have to be positive. You just have to say, come on, we can do this. And look, I go to other countries and I'm flying out to one later on today where stuff gets made literally in a heartbeat. You know, you go away for 6 months, you come back, there's a huge building, there's a huge flyover. And the thing we need to do in this country is to keep that optimism, to say we can build stuff, we can make stuff. We are still very good at what we do. We are thought leaders. If you go back to electric cars, we are the most successful electric car market in Europe. We've overtaken France and Germany. So that's the optimism that I like to sort of carry with me on my shoulder and pass on to other people, that, you know, if you've got this will, you've got this determination, you have this optimism, this vision, you can translate that to other people and things start to happen. But we have this mindset where we can't even build a railway, let alone, you know, roads and things like that. We can't fix the roads we've got. So we've got to get away from that and start being optimistic in everything we do and having this can-do mentality.
Yes, and a lot of hauliers and also a lot of PSV operators will be, this is great, but it's really too difficult. And at the moment, I'm just trying to get my goods to market or carry my passengers around. And that's for other people to do. It was a little bit like I was part of Think Logistics promoting young people to come into the industry. And everybody's, yeah, how much money do you want? We don't want money. We want you to actually do something.
Yeah.
And it's often, well, I'll do it when I have to. You know, the commercial vehicle industry is not always known for being early adopters of technology. And I think it's quite polarised. Do you agree with that? Very polarised in that you've got some really fabulous, first-class, innovative operators because they've got, quite frankly, the money and the resource to do it. And then the others that just haven't got the time or resource to be able to. They'd love to, but they probably can't devote that time and attention to it and the money.
That's right. And we have to support those who don't have the time. And we all know what it's like to run a small to medium sized enterprise and be beleaguered by all the daily stuff and not being able to look at that strategic vision and that picture of what's it going to be like in 5 years. So the industry has to come together and try not to be as polarized as it is and understand that this change is coming and there's nothing that's going to stop it. And unless we start thinking, right, this is what the future looks like. And if you listen, and I don't want to politicise this, you listen to Nigel Farage.
It's interesting. It's interesting. Go on.
And reform, that they want us to go backwards, that they want us, you know, they're going to tax renewable energy and they're going to do everything they can to block wind farms and everything. And you just think, why? You know, why? What we're wanting is clean air for our children.
Yes.
Energy independence, so we don't have to have these volatile swings of prices of fossil fuel and gas, and just cheaper energy for all. And this wonderful vision of being off-grid, Beverly, where you've got solar panels on your house and you've got a battery inside, and for 90% of the time, you don't have any energy bills. You're hooked up to the grid, so when there is intermittency with wind and solar, you can top it up. But for the bulk of your time, you can generate electricity from sun and then you can use it to power your car, your washing machine, everything in your house, your heating. And if you take that drag away from the economy of energy, it's just, you know, incredibly just liberty, isn't it? It's a huge amount taken out of the economy that's wasted, and people's budgets.
Yes, I couldn't agree more. So back in 2017, we did a bit of research and we looked at the price of fuel. You know all about the price of fuel. July 2017, 114 pence a litre. May 2025, 133 pence. 2022, 191 pence. What does that teach us, Quentin, about reliance on fossil fuels and where we should be going?
That they are innately volatile and we can't control them. And I think the development since 2017, Beverly, is that OPEC can't control them either. So traditionally, OPEC is a group of oil-producing countries who got together and created this thing called, well, it's OPEC Plus now, so it's Saudi Arabia and Russia mainly, who then restrict supply and then the prices go up. But they've tried to do that recently because the price of crude's come down an awful lot because of what Trump's been doing, and we're under $60 a barrel now. So they've released more supplies instead of trying to shore up the price because they just want volume now. Now, these people are controlling our economies. They're controlling our interest rates. They're controlling, you know, how much we pay to fuel our cars and to heat our homes. And it's up and down. And those figures, you know, what was it, 114, 190, 134. It's artificially depressed now because Trump has done what he's done to crude prices. So it could be nearly 200 a barrel. But, you know, that kind of, you cannot be tied to those monopolistic petrostates who just are out for their own gain. We as a country have to have energy independence. We can't keep importing all this stuff and paying these prices. And the reason we had the 2008 recession was that oil got to $145 a barrel, the highest it's ever been, and the whole thing just collapsed. So look, these lessons are really clear if you look for them. If you look through history and see how we've been shackled to the price of oil and what it does to us, and it can suddenly just collapse the whole economy, then we've got to say, we don't want to repeat this, do we? And look at Ukraine and the price of gas. Yes. You know, but people complain about electricity being the most expensive now in the UK, in Europe, but that's because gas is so high, and gas is part of, well, it's the major component in the energy generation chain, and that's the highest price, so that's what we get charged, and that's got to change as well. We need reform with the electricity market. So there's a lot that needs to be done, but what we've done so far, and why I say to Nigel, who I like very much indeed and I've worked with him over many years, is to say, look, you know, let's not go back in time, and let's not have this smoky, polluted Britain where we burn more oil and petrol and diesel, and the idea that we're going to drill all the remaining stuff out, the depleted North Sea basin, that's not going to work either, because we can't use that oil and gas. We have to sell it on the international market so other countries will get it. So this whole thing about what they call stupid net zero is, you know, it's going to take us backward and it's going to threaten jobs. We had, what was it, 46 billion inward investment into clean energy since July 2004. 46, but that's a lot of money. You know, is the oil and gas industries putting that sort of money in to the UK? I'm not sure.
Probably not. So let's hope he listens. But can I ask you about something else which is sort of coming down the road, if you'll pardon the pun? Autonomous driverless vehicles. Interesting. What's your take on it for the commercial vehicle sector? I'm going to ask you first about lorries, and then maybe ask a little bit about buses and coaches. So what's your take on it, Quentin?
I think it's a long way away. I mean, we hear all these tremendously wonderful stories, and we've had a succession of government ministers who have been saying that we'll have autonomous driving cars in the UK within a couple of years, and all these big windy pronouncements. But I mean, Tesla have fully self-driving in their cars, which is reasonably successful in America, but it's not perfect. And they've got systems in China which are working now. But everybody I talk to in the industry says that for commercial vehicles, it's a long way off, because the potential there of it all going horribly wrong is massive. There will be systems where you will have convoys of lorries, which are largely controlled autonomously. You'll still have a driver there, but that's a possibility. But the idea of them, you know, going through the high streets of the UK autonomously, I think is a long, long way away, as indeed it is, Beverly, for passenger cars. And I think for PSV vehicles, coaches, buses, I'm not sure that would ever happen. You know, I've been in buses in the Middle East and things which are autonomous, and they're great, but yeah. these are largely experimental things, and they're not in a large road network. Can you imagine a minibus full of kids autonomous going down Park Lane in London?
No,
I wouldn't want to be on it, and would you? And it's the gulf between the connected and unconnected. So you've got your autonomous vehicle, which is working really, really well, and you've got all the technology. And then you've got lots of people who aren't autonomous and aren't connected and are humans. And that's where the friction starts. So we shouldn't poo-poo it. We should say, right, we need to do this. It's important. But I think it's a long way off. So commercial vehicle operators shouldn't really worry about that one too much.
I agree with you. I think when you look at warehousing and automation, completely different.
Yeah.
You know, are we going to have last mile deliveries by drone, for example, in a few years' time? They tried to introduce it on the Isle of Wight, where I live, and it didn't work for all sorts of reasons. But I can see that happening much more than autonomous driverless vehicles. So can I ask you a little bit now about safety? We've talked about energy. We've talked about the driver. For me, as somebody that works in the commercial vehicle sector, the two biggest risks for any commercial vehicle operator is the driver. And then for me, the tyres. There's an awful lot of stuff, as you know, from the work you've done. What do you think the biggest safety risks are facing commercial vehicle operators, apart from the driver?
I think, yes, it's mechanical integrity. So we see far too many tyres on lorries that have disintegrated on motorways. If you look at the billions of miles travelled, as I said earlier, the safety regime is really working, clearly. Mm. And the amount of accidents we have with HGVs are tiny. I mean, are barely measurable.
Mm.
I think there's been a slight increase. I don't have the figures in front of me, but you know, the industry should stand back and say, look, we've done a great job. And all those drivers, the tachographs and things like that, the rest periods, it's all contributed to a really, really good standard of driving skill on UK roads from HGV drivers. So I don't think there's a great risk. I think you've got to look at maintenance and you've got to look at tyre wear. But I'm not seeing, you know, huge amounts of accidents being caused by that. What I'm seeing is anecdotally lots of lorries on the hard shoulder with fragmented tyres. And there must be a way to kind of reduce that, because it impacts other vehicles when the tyres just disintegrated on the carriageway and there are bits of shards all over the road and stuff like that. But I think the industry should stand back and say, we do a good job and we are broadly very, very safe indeed.
I completely agree with that. My former colleague, Joan Aitken, used to talk about the invisibility of success.
Yeah.
You can't measure how many incidents don't happen as a result of the measures that are being taken. So you used to be obviously a presenter for a couple of car shows, one of which has had some problems with regard to safety.
Yep.
Because when people do inherently dangerous things, it can go horribly wrong. What's your take on that now?
Look, it was really regrettable that they had these accidents with Freddie and Richard. And the thing with car programmes is that when you push the envelope, things go wrong. And the BBC, bless them, you know, they're not an organisation which has this infrastructure of health and safety, particularly when it comes to cars and vehicles. And a lot of it was kind of made up as you went along. I mean, in my day, we would be filming out the back of a Ford Mondeo with the hatch up, held up with a broomstick, and the cameraman strapped into the back, and he's filming as you're driving. I mean, hugely dangerous, you know.
But fun, I mean, but fun.
Fun, yeah. And I remember crashing a Ditto Masso in on Silverstone because the director wanted me to go the wrong way around the circuit while it was raining to catch the clouds in a particular sequence. And I should have said, no. I'm not, you know, I'm not James Hunt. I'm not going to do that. But I did, and I spun it. So, you know, you've got to be really, really careful. And it's sad that the brand, because we do need a car show now more than ever.
Definitely. Yes.
Absolutely. And Top Gear, you know, was a great brand that was watched by so many people. So it's sad, but these things do happen. And when you're driving these cars at great speed, you need to have a proper system of health and safety and guys to come and, well, killjoys to come and say, no, you can't do that. You'll kill yourself.
Yes. It's a balance, isn't it? So you started out, if I can ask you, working in the car trade.
Yes. And... So I went to university, did English literature, found I could do nothing with it, and then started up a small car business. And then...
So have you always been interested in cars?
Oh, yeah, ever since formative years. I mean, for my 11th birthday, I got a Ford Anglia engine and took it to pieces. And got it working again.
Well, I'll share a little story with you. I went to Merchant Taylor School in Crosby, which was at that time quite posh, still is. And I came home and said, oh, Mummy, we all found out what everybody's daddies do today. And she said, oh, what do they do? So I told them they were bishops and solicitors, etc. She said, what did you say? I said, oh, I said, my daddy's in the motor trade. And she said, it's nothing to be proud of, Beverly. Which still makes me laugh. I love the car industry. I obviously work in the commercial vehicle industry now, and I love everything about it. And I've always enjoyed cars. I don't take them apart, Quentin. I just drive them, and I try to drive them slowly. So your interest started in the mechanics of it. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, I got the A book of the car for my birthday, and then bought a socket set, and then we got this engine and took it to pieces, and it was all self-taught. And then I looked after my dad's cars and polished them up. And so he was very proud. We went to university and parked this old Daimler, and everybody admired it. So it just kind of begun like that. And then I started to buy and sell cars, and then did this magazine with this guy who's now editor, or one of the editors of Autocar, which was successful. And then got a call from the BBC and said, would you like to come and present Top Gear?
Well, it can't have been that simple. I was going to ask, how did you go from what you were doing to presenting Top Gear?
Because I was the only voice out there who could write about cars, but also knew what they were talking about. So I used to do these things about what to buy, what's hot, what's not. And I still do it for the classic car magazines. And back then, there was no stuff about secondhand cars. You know, it was all journalism about shiny new cars. So this unique voice that talked about, you know, don't buy a brand new one, buy this one because you'll save $5,000, $6,000, got real resonance. And the BBC just picked it up and said, can we do a screen test? And before I knew where I was sitting next to Clarkson. And, you know, the rest is history, as they say.
So what's your real passion in all the work you've done? You've done so many different things, some really lighthearted and fun, some really, really serious. What really motivates you?
I think it's really easy to just, you know, have a lovely time driving supercars around airfields. But ultimately, that doesn't really make any difference. It makes fleeting marks behind the eyes and slips away. I think the greatest joy is that I've been able to make a difference and save people money. So, you know, I did the block exemption thing where we had cars that you buy in the UK were more expensive than cars in Europe, even though they were made in the UK. So I did that, and we did it on Top Gear. We took it to the European Commission. And then I got prices regularized. So that saved about 3 billion. So I thought, right then, what else can we do? And then we did the fair fuel thing.
Can I just interrupt you? You're very modest about that. What you did and the influence you had was huge.
Well, it's very nice of you to say so, Beverly, you know, but I'm a great believer of not kind of dwelling on what you have done. Let's move on and do something else. So then I looked at the prices of fuel, as we said, and Alistair Darling was doing this thing with Labour where he would have a fuel escalator. So it would.
Yes, I remember. I remember it very well.
Every quarter. And I said, this is going to bankrupt us. Absolutely. So I got together with some other people and said, right, let's start this campaign and make government aware that what they're doing will ultimately debilitate the economy. Started up Fair Fuel and saved, I think, over the 11 years that we suspended every single fuel duty rise, of maybe 100 million in VAT and fuel duty. And the Treasury, who don't often compliment, said, look, the effect of Fair Fuel will be felt for decades to come. And that's great. And I just want to stress that I was never paid for that. I did it completely pro bono because it was the right thing to do. You know, nobody pays you to do these campaigns. So that's great. And then when I bought my, I think, seventh electric car and found that I could get down to London and back from the Midlands on one charge, one overnight charge, I thought, we need to change now from hydrocarbons and change to electrons. And that's the future. So that's what I've been campaigning for now.
And have you been watching the truck cartel developments?
Yes.
From the sidelines?
I think, yeah, look, we get these things in the car industry too, and the parts industry and stuff like that. And it's all very regrettable. And the industry really should hang its head sometimes and say, you know, they shouldn't be doing this. And perhaps we better not mention any names and things like that.
No, but, of course not.
It is disappointing. But it goes on, and it goes on in every industry, Beverly. And I think you've just got to be realistic about that.
Oh, for sure it goes on in every industry. So I'm about to change my car. Should I buy electric?
Well, if you've got enough space at home to put a charge point in, so you could charge your car at night at 7.5p per kilowatt hour, and you're in the Isle of Wight, yeah. I mean, great.
I'd love to. Unfortunately, I live in a, well, not unfortunately, I live in an apartment block with an underground garage. And so some people would say, oh, it's too much of a fire risk charging your cars in an underground car park. We won't get into that. But on principle, you would say get an electric car.
Yeah, completely. Because, you know, you're going to save money, loads and loads of money. And if you buy them secondhand, it's going to be cheaper than a petrol or a combustion car. And also on the fire point, Beverly, you were 20 times more likely to have a fire in a combustion car than you are in an electric car. And we know all this data now, you know, that it's proven beyond doubt that they catch fire much less regularly than petrol or diesel.
You know, I'm glad you told me that because I'll tell the management company and that will help.
They do, because all this stuff has come from social media and it just embeds itself. And, you know, you get hospitals closing their car parks because we can't park electric cars there. And it's just nonsense. Anyway, move on.
Okay, I'll move on. And I've got two more questions for you. So we look back to 2017, which is 8 years ago, which to me seems like yesterday, quite frankly. Looking forward 10 years, 2035. What do you think the commercial vehicle sector is going to look like?
Well, I hope that it will be vibrant, that we will have managed to support it and empower it and invest in it. So we've got new skills, new drivers, new processes, new systems, new lorries, new infrastructure. But I think we're only going to do that if we all in the industry collectively try and make that change. And we go back to the remarks we had earlier on about getting industry to liaise more with government, because that won't happen organically. You know, it's something with an industry on such low margins that they can't really pursue growth as a centerpiece. They have to pursue it when they've got, you know, some time and it affects their bottom line. But there needs to be an outside force saying, right, we need to grow this industry. We need to manage it. We need to make it really professional, low pollution, sustainable, so people will invest and promote it for the future. Whether that's going to come by 2035, I don't know. But it's a mindset, Beverly. It's a culture. It, you know, let's do it. Let's want it. Let's say, right, we are going to make this happen.
And that's very clear from the way you are when you're talking to me. You've got that very positive and optimistic mindset. Do you get that from your father?
Bless him. I mean, I suppose it must be in my DNA, yeah. You just have two choices in life, don't you? You can sit around and whinge and moan, or you can say, right, come on, let's go and do it.
And what influence did your mother have on your career? Did she want you to go to university? Did she want to read English literature?
So my mum and dad were university academics. So dad was a professor of German at Leicester University. And my mother was a St Andrews graduate who, again, was an English lecturer. So there was this huge pressure. And both my brothers went to Cambridge, Trinity Cambridge, as did my father. So they wanted me to go to Trinity Cambridge, but I didn't because I was intimidated by it. Long story anyway. So, yes, pushed hard for me to become a teacher or a lecturer. But, you know, I just saw these cars and thought, wow, this is a fantastic, exciting world. And I'd rather do that than read Milton or Shelley or Byron or Keats. Although I still do. But it was just one of those things, you know, and they were lovely people and they made me what I am. And I found out, you know, much later in life that my father played a really, you know, significant role at Bletchley Park.
Oh. Yes, that was fascinating to read when I was researching you. So, well, I love English literature as well, but I did law instead, which I followed my passion, you followed your passion. You've been really kind in answering all the questions I've thrown at you. There is an opportunity, it's purely voluntary, if there's anything you'd like to ask me. You may not, because you obviously work in a very different world from me, but there's an opportunity if you want to.
I think, Beverly, what I would say to you, that, you know, your experience working as a traffic commissioner, and those were difficult times. There was a lot of political noise going on. How did you navigate all those political obstacles, all that ministerial fudging and all those things you have to do when you work in that sector?
I think, like you, I always remained optimistic. I think as long as you are true to your own values, that stands you in good stead. Being really clear about what you expect and what you want. I don't live in a world where I eat fudge. I'm very black and white. Well, for a lawyer, I'm fairly black and white, bearing in mind there are lots of shades of grey. And I think you've got to be really clear what you want and just go for it. Recognising you can't please all the people all the time. You're always going to upset somebody.
Yeah.
But as long as it feels right in here, then that's where you go with it. Somebody did once say to me, rather sort of jokingly, ministers may come and ministers may go, but traffic commissioners tend to be there for a lot longer than ministers. It is true. And the beauty and the advantage of traffic commissioners is that they are politically independent.
Yeah.
And they're there to regulate an industry that does a fabulous job. And that's why I think they are so respected by the industry, because they work for the industry. And also, I didn't mind ruffling a few feathers every now and again. You know, God made me into some sort of northern, plain-speaking woman. I tried to counteract that by living on the Isle of Wight, but have failed miserably. So I think as long as you're true to yourself, then you'll probably get quite a long way. So that
ruffling feathers is important.
Yes.
It means you're making a difference.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Do I feel younger now than I did when I retired? Absolutely. Because you're right. It was very challenging. You know, Richard Turfitt has just stood down as the senior traffic commissioner, having served his time. And I know, like me, he'll be tired and not worn out, but tired from a really challenging role. Do I miss it? No. Do I love my current role? Absolutely. And that's thanks to you.
Well, that's really sweet of you to say so, Beverly. Thank you very much indeed.
Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us. I personally could talk to you for much longer, but I know you've got a plane
Likewise.
To catch.
Yeah.
And thank you. You take care.
My pleasure, Beverly. All the very best. Bye-bye.
As we conclude another fascinating journey through the world of transport and logistics, we want to express our sincere appreciation for listening. Your support means the world to us. Keep the conversation going by reaching out on social media with your questions and feedback. We're eager to hear from you and continue exploring together. Until next time, stay curious, stay informed, and check out our other episodes online. Take care on the roads and see you in the next episode.